John McCarthy was an assistant professor at MIT in 1959. He was a young man with thick glasses and a high forehead and a habit of speaking very slowly when he was thinking very fast. And he had recently coined a phrase that nobody else in the world used yet, the phrase artificial intelligence. He was sitting on the afternoon I am picturing for you in a small office on the second floor of a brick building in Cambridge, Massachusetts, with the windows open onto a quiet street, the smell of the river not too far off, and a sheet of paper in front of him covered in symbols that looked, to anyone walking past, more like mathematics than like programming. The mathematics describe a language he was inventing for thinking about symbolic problems, a language he called LISP, short for Lisp processing. In Lisp, every program was made of small linked cells, each cell holding two pieces of information, and the cells could be chained together in a long structures that represented sentences, formulas, theorems, anything that could be reasoned about. The trouble McCarthy was thinking about that afternoon was the cells. As a program ran, it built more and more of them. Some of the cells, after a little while, were no longer reachable from any of the program's active threads of thought, abandoned by every part of the running code. And yet the cells themselves were still sitting in memory, taking up space that the program would eventually need back. Asking the human programmer to remember which cells could be safely thrown away, in a language as fluid and recursive as Lisp, struck McCarthy as impossible. People would forget. People would throw away cells they should have kept and keep cells they should have thrown away. The bugs would be horrible. The programs would crash. So McCarthy invented something else. He invented a small background process that, when memory got tight, would pause the program, walk through every cell the program could still reach, mark each one, and then sweep through the rest of memory and throw away everything that had not been marked. Reclaim it. Hand it back to the pool. The program could then resume, with fresh memory available, none the wiser. He called the process garbage collection. He published the idea in 1960, and Lisp 1.5, which shipped around 1962, included it. McCarthy did not know it yet, but the idea he had just casually written into the design of his small research language would, in time, run inside almost every piece of software you have ever touched. This is Rust, gently. A patient introduction to how computers actually work and to one particular language for talking to them. I am your host. This is episode 24, The Garbage Collector. Today I want to tell you the story of garbage collection because it is the second great answer the industry tried to give to the memory bug problem we talked about last time, and because understanding it is essential to understanding why Rust feels so different from almost every other language you might have heard of. By the end of the episode, you will know what a garbage collector actually does, why it became the default for a whole generation of programming languages, what hidden cost it carries, and why Rust deliberately, carefully, and at some real expense to itself, chose not to have one. Let me back up and explain what a garbage collector actually does in plain words. When a program runs, it constantly creates new things. A list of names, a user record, a photograph. Each of these things lives in a region of memory the program asks the operating system for, somewhere off in the long, mostly empty stretch of memory the program has been given. The thing exists, it is used, perhaps it is passed around between different parts of the program for a while, and then, eventually, no part of the program needs it anymore. At that moment, the memory it lives in is, in a strict sense, wasted. The program has moved on. The memory is just sitting there. If the program never gets that memory back, it will, over time, run out, the way an apartment will eventually run out of room if you never throw anything away. There are two ways to handle this. The first way is to ask the human programmer to handle it. In C, which we talked about last episode, the programmer calls a function called free by hand on every piece of memory they want to give back at the exact moment they decide it is no longer needed. This is fast because the program does it on its own schedule with no help from any background process. But it is also dangerous because the programmer can forget or can freeze something too early while another part of the program is still holding a pointer to it. And the resulting bugs are exactly the family of bugs we spent last episode worrying about. The second way is to let the language do it for you. That is what McCarthy's garbage collector does. Instead of asking the programmer to call free, the language quietly keeps track of which pieces of memory are still reachable from the program's active variables and which ones are not, and reclaims the unreachable ones automatically, every now and then, while the program is doing other things. The programmer never has to think about freeing memory at all. The programmer just creates things, uses them, and stops referring to them. The garbage collector takes care of the rest. That is the trade. You give up some of the speed and the predictability of doing it yourself in exchange for never having to do it. For an enormous amount of software, that trade is fantastic. The idea that McCarthy invented for Lisp moved out of academia and into the mainstream in May of 1995, the day Sun Microsystems released a new language called Java. Java was led by an engineer named James Gosling, and its pitch to the world was, write once, run anywhere. You write your program in Java once, and it runs on Windows, on Mac, on Unix, on anything that has a Java virtual machine installed. That was the public pitch. The technical pitch, the one that actually mattered to working programmers, was that ordinary application developers no longer had to think about memory. No more calling free. No more pointer bookkeeping. No more dangling references. The garbage collector inside the Java virtual machine took care of all of it, and it was good enough that most of the time you genuinely did not notice it was there. Java's success was so total that for the next 30 years, the phrase modern programming language essentially meant programming language with a garbage collector. C# inherited the pattern from Java directly. JavaScript, the language of the web browser, has had a garbage collector built into every browser since the beginning. Python has won. Ruby has won. Go, the language Google released in 2009 and that we have mentioned a few times in this show, has won. Kotlin, Swift, Dart, Scala, Clojure, every one of the popular application languages of the last 20 years, with a small number of exceptions, has won. If you have ever written a line of code in any of these languages, you have leaned, possibly without knowing it, on the gentle, invisible work of John McCarthy's idea. For most software, this is wonderful. For some software, it is a disaster. The reason it is sometimes a disaster is that a garbage collector has to pause your program, at least a little bit, in order to do its work. It has to look at every variable, walk every reachable structure, mark what is alive, sweep up what is dead. While it is doing that, the rest of the program has to be very careful, or in some cases has to wait. These pauses are called, in the literature, stop the world pauses because, briefly, the rest of the world inside your program does in fact stop. Modern garbage collectors are very clever about minimizing the length of these pauses. Java's most advanced collector, called ZGC, can do most of its work concurrently and keep the pauses down to single-digit milliseconds. Go's collector is similarly impressive. For most applications you would ever write, these pauses are invisible. You would not notice them. They would not affect anyone. For a small but important class of software, they are catastrophic. A real-time video game cannot afford a 30-millisecond pause in the middle of a frame because the player will see the stutter. A live audio processor cannot afford it because the sound will glitch. A low-latency trading system cannot afford it because the market moves faster than the pause. A chat backend serving millions of users cannot afford it because the slowest users will get a response a half second late. And at scale, half a second late is the difference between a good service and a bad one. The story that is sometimes told to illustrate this in a Rust community is the story of a chat company called Discord in February of 2020. Discord runs the chat backend for an enormous number of communities online. One of their internal services, the one that tracked which messages each user had already read, was written in Go and had been carefully tuned by the team for many months. The service worked. It did its job. But every 2 minutes, exactly, the latency of the service would spike for a brief moment. There is a famous graph the team posted in a blog post by an engineer named Jesse Howarth, a graph that has been passed around the Rust community ever since. The graph looked like the teeth of a saw, smooth low lines with sharp tall spikes appearing on a steady rhythm. Every 2 minutes, like clockwork. Every 2 minutes, Go's garbage collector kicked in, scanned through the service's enormous heap, and the pause showed up as a spike on the graph. The team had tried everything. They had tuned the collector. They had reshaped the data. They had thrown more memory at the problem. None of it removed the teeth on the graph, because the teeth were not a bug they could tune away. The teeth were the cost of having a garbage collector at all. So Discord rewrote the service in Rust. The new graph, which they also posted, is a flat line. Note these. The memory the new service used dropped from gigabytes to megabytes. The slowest requests, the ones at the 99th percentile, dropped from hundreds of milliseconds to single-digit milliseconds. Same work. Different language. The teeth were gone. This is where Rust's third way comes in. Before Rust, the choice in a serious systems language was binary. You could have C, which is fast and dangerous, with all the memory bugs we talked about last episode. Or you could have a language with a garbage collector, like Java or Go, which is safe but pays the pause tax. Rust offers a third option, which is the thing that makes the language genuinely different, not just a polished version of one of the older two. The idea is called ownership. Every value in a Rust program has exactly one owner. When the owner goes out of scope, when the function it lives in returns, when the loop it belongs to ends, when the program has finished using it, the value is freed deterministically at a moment the compiler can prove is safe. There is no garbage collector. There is no manual call to free. The compiler watches the lifetimes of values as you write your code, and it refuses to compile programs that would leave a value dangling or free a value too soon. The rules are enforced at build time, not at runtime, which means there is no background process and no pause and no overhead at all when the program eventually runs. The idea is not entirely new. Pieces of it have appeared in research languages going back decades. Linear types from the 1980s. Region-based memory management. A research language called Cyclone in the early 2000s. Horizon earlier languages before Rust. What Rust did, that none of the earlier languages had managed, was to make the rules ergonomic enough that ordinary working programmers could use them without going mad, and to ship the toolchain, the compiler, the package manager, the documentation, the error messages, in a shape that made the discipline routine rather than heroic. That combination of an old academic idea and a relentless focus on the developer experience is what made Rust the language that finally moved this third way out of the research papers and into the production systems of major companies. It is worth saying out loud that this third way is not a free lunch. Rust asks more of you, as the programmer, than Java or Go ever did. The compiler will refuse to build a program that does not satisfy its rules. And learning to write code that satisfies the rules takes longer than learning to write code in a language that simply trusts you and inserts a garbage collector underneath you. The trade is that, once you have learned, the program you ship has no hidden runtime tax. No background process. No pause. No teeth on the latency graph. For a great deal of software, that trade is not worth making, and a garbage collected language is the right answer. For an increasingly large and important class of software, the system software underneath the modern internet, the games, the audio processors, the trading systems, the chat backends, the trade has tipped the other way. That is the territory Rust now lives in. Three things to carry away from today. The first is that the garbage collector, invented by John McCarthy in 1959 for a research language called Lisp, became the dominant answer to memory management for an entire generation of mainstream languages, from Java to Go to Python to almost every other application language you have ever heard of. The second is that the garbage collector pays a hidden cost in the form of brief pauses, called stop-the-world pauses, that are invisible to most software, but catastrophic to the small class of low-latency software where every millisecond counts, which is exactly the class of software where systems engineers spend most of their time. The third is that Rust deliberately, carefully refuses the garbage collector and offers instead a third way, called ownership, where memory is free to compile time, determine moments without any runtime overhead, and the safety is enforced not by a background process, but by the compiler before your program ever runs. Next time on Rust, gently, we will leave history behind for a moment and look at the present, at the great wave of rewrites that has reshaped the daily tooling of every working software engineer over the last several years. We will meet a man in Boulder, Colorado, who replaced the venerable Unix grep with something 10 times faster, and we will trace the same pattern through every corner of the modern software stack. Until then, take good care of yourself. I will see you in the next one.